Hello, welcome to this episode of The Voice of the Underdog, the podcast that explores the relationship between challenger branding and company culture. I'm Michael Tuggle, and I'm here with my friend and co-author, Loomis President and CEO, Mike Sullivan. In this final episode of our inaugural season, we're looking back at some of our favorite moments from the discussions we've had with our guests here on The Voice of the Underdog in 2021. We've talked with authors, bankers, marketers, and entrepreneurs, all outstanding leaders, and not surprisingly, all advocates of building and curating extraordinary cultures. During the next hour, we're going to share their stories with you, their insights, some surprising revelations, and why thinking like a challenger brand and having that underdog mindset has served them well and driven the kind of success we all hope to have. This is the Voice of the Underdog, Best of 2021 podcast. Thanks for joining us.
This episode of The Voice of the Underdog is sponsored by Luminous Sound Studios, Dallas's premier recording studio for music, production, audio post, and all things sound. For more than 25 years, Luminous Sound has been the place to go for original music for television, radio, and film, and the preferred Dallas studio for artists coast to coast. For more information, visit luminoussound.com.
Welcome back to The Voice of the Underdog, Best of 2021 podcast. For our inaugural episode back in May, we were privileged to have our good friend David Emerald join us as our first guest. David is the author of a number of books, most notably The Power of TED, The Empowerment Dynamic. As a consultant and executive coach for more than 20 years, David has worked with thousands of executives and transformed the lives of hundreds of thousands of people with his simple but powerful book. We asked David to share with our listeners why The Power of TED has been so influential and what, in his opinion, is the one thing that sets successful leaders apart.
The Power of TED is actually a fable that I characterize as a fable on self-leadership, because I firmly believe that the way we lead our own lives has everything to do with the leadership that we bring to our organizations, to our to all of our stakeholders, our customers, et cetera. And I will quickly mention that I've also subsequently written a book that is a little bit more organizationally focused called The Three Vital Questions. But The Power of TED was really the original book that launched this work. And very briefly, what's in The Power of TED is some fairly simple ways of thinking and relating to others that can have a great deal of impact. And I'll just do a real quick overview of those things, is that what we find is that what our mindset is, and I know that mindset is really critical to your challenger work and challenger brand work, but the predominant mindset for most of us as human beings is problem-focused, anxiety-based, and reactive in nature. Whereas challengers, in the way that you are encouraging the mindset, tend to be what I call outcome focused, and that outcome focus taps into passion that then drives the what I'll call baby step behaviors that eventually lead to the outcomes that you want to create. And then the book also introduces the idea of what I call dynamic tension, which is a process for creating outcomes and staying focused on those outcomes while also telling the truth about current reality. And I have a feeling as we go along, I'll say a little bit more about all of those realms, but it's really about thinking about how we think, thinking about how we relate to others and our experience and frankly ourselves, and thinking about how we take action in service to outcomes.
That's awesome. Well, David, we've been talking a lot about the challenger mindset, you know, throughout the beginning of the podcast. And when you read through TED, you know, you talk a lot about the creator mindset, and it seems to me that they're very similar. I mean, would you agree with that?
Yes. And the creator mindset, is, as you're referring to it, is that outcome-focused, passion-based way of being and thinking. That is, so to me, the challenger mindset that you speak to and really having a creator mindset are absolutely the same thing. That it's about being focused on what is it we're trying to create, If we had what we wanted to create, how would we know it? And continuing to keep that focus in mind, frankly, even when you're solving problems, and rather than just reacting to the problems du jour. So to me, they are absolutely coming from the same way of approaching work, life, et cetera. It's about staying outcome focused.
Right. Well, let me ask you this. So when you read through TED, right, the antithesis of what you call the creator mindset is the victim mindset, right? So how hard do you think it would be, when we talk a lot about challengers and, you know, being in that headspace, how hard do you think it would be for challengers with a victim mindset to succeed?
I think it'd be really difficult, because the victim mindset, again, really stands for, if you will, and is really focused on looking for problems to react to. And it's reactive in nature. And one of the things that, without going too theoretical here, that I would say is that the victim mindset can result in short-term and incremental change, but it really requires an outcome orientation as a creator to really create sustainable change, and from a business standpoint, to put the processes and the systems and the structures into place that lead to that sustainable change. You know, if I can refer back to some of what I know you were talking about earlier and is very key to your book, is that, you know, it seems to me that the mattress firm that tried to react to your mattress client,
yep,
that they were coming from, frankly, a victim, that they saw the 1 year love your mattress money back guarantee as a problem that they had to react to, and they couldn't sustainably react to that. They had to go back to their old ways because they were reacting to it as a problem. So that's a long way of saying I think it's really difficult for the victim mindset to succeed as a challenger brand, and especially to sustain the challenger brand mindset.
You know, ultimately, this all comes down to leadership, and obviously great communication is a fundamental, you know, when it comes to leadership. But, you know, I guess you've been generous with your time. So I've got one last question here. So you've been looking at leaders and studying leadership for more than 3 decades now. And after all that you've seen and all the people you've coached, because you do a lot of coaching as well, what would you say is the one thing in your mind that sets successful leaders apart from those who just struggle with leadership?
Great question, and I'm going to sound like a broken record, but to me, this is it, is that great leaders fight with themselves, fight, I don't mean violently, but they fight to stay outcome focused. They fight their own inner tendency to want to react to that tension, to want to react to what's going on in their marketplace, et cetera. But they fight to stay outcome focused. Second, I'm going to actually give you a couple things because they're all related. Mm-hmm. Because they also tell the truth about current reality, which again is that tension in relation to the outcome. And they learn, they grow, they develop themselves and their businesses from challengers in the TED sense, again, challengers that call forth learning and growth, that they see it as a continuing to evolve process. And very importantly, and I think to me, I also want to underscore this, is they see all of their stakeholders, their employees, their associates, their customers, their vendors. They see everyone as creators in their own right and as co-creators in service to their customers and marketplaces.
For challenger brands, success isn't about finding a better way to play the game. It's about finding a way to change the game. When David fought Goliath, he didn't try to figure out a better way to grapple with a giant. He won by completely rethinking the rules of combat. And that's the same approach First United CEO Greg Massey has taken with the banking industry, and with similar results. Once a small hometown bank in tiny Durant, Oklahoma, under Greg's leadership, First United has expanded across the state and into Texas, amassing assets in excess of $12 billion. We talked with Greg about changing banking for the better and how leading with love and empathy rather than pure finance makes all the difference.
You know, one of the stories, Greg, that you tell, and you've done a lot of speaking at universities, and the story that I love is the talk that you give to students in finance classes about the role that money plays in people's lives, either for good or it can be for bad. And I think there's something in the DNA of First United's culture that goes right back to that talk, because, you know, your typical banker is not going to show up to a finance class and have the kind of discussion that you have. Would you kind of just sort of summarize that discussion of what you do when you talk to kids?
I tell, you know, different stories. I remember one time I was, it was at a high school and talking about, it was like a career day in banking. Yeah. And I had a mom in the back of the room, and it was at the very end of the talk, and she raised her hand. I said, "Yes, ma'am." She said, "Don't you think it's time for these kids to, start working on their credit and get a credit card?" And I literally like screamed. I was like, "No, that's the last thing they need. They all need a savings account. Because the only thing I know is something's bad going to happen to every one of us over time. We might lose our job. It might be a health issue. And the only people that have good credit are people that have a backup plan. So let's start with the backup plan and before we even consider credit." So it's been interesting, even, you know, in the financial service industry, just how we've pushed credit on people and versus getting it the right size.
Yeah.
And so if we can, you know, we want people to have home ownership, and most people are going to need debt to do that.
Yeah.
But let's get them the right size of mortgage that they can afford and also be able to save money like they need to save for the future, for the retirement. So it's just all about, you know, getting it sized up for them in the right way and have a longer term perspective. And today, you know, in the world, we want these, what I call short-term gains.
Yeah.
But if we can have a perspective of a longer term perspective and give up something for today so we can have a better future for tomorrow.
Yeah, you know, and so as you think about that and kind of imbuing that into a culture, the banking industry isn't oriented that way. And so how do you recruit folks, get people aligned around a culture like that? I know it can't happen all at once. I know it's a journey. Maybe talk through a little bit, you know, how you accomplish that.
Sure. So, you know, early on, we were talking about just how do we truly help other folks, and you and Tuggle really helped us, remember, articulate Spend Life Wisely.
Yeah.
And we went through research of on, you know, how do we resonate with our customers and our employees to turn on this thought process of how do we make proper choices in our lives. And so that was a way that the three of us really came up with, was the word Spend Life Wisely. And so today we say our purpose, our intentions of being in business collectively, is to inspire and empower. So how do we encourage, how do we motivate, how do we give people the tools they need to spend life wisely? Mm-hmm. And that really creates a culture. So you tie that back in to recruiting our people inside the company today. They're there because they want that intentions. And so just like our own personal life, if we have true intentions in our life, we have a reason to get out of bed and motivate. So that's how we get someone to, instead of having a job versus having a career versus having a calling.
Yep.
So when someone has a calling, see, a calling is is I'm there for a true intentions to make a person better off. So, you know, I used to say, you know, I'd rather go home and say I made impact on someone's life today versus come home and say, I made three loans. Like, if I went home to my wife, I made three loans. She's like, well, who cares?
Yeah.
But I can say, man, I met with this customer and we truly made impact. I mean, I get excited even talking about
that. Yeah, we worked out a financial problem that they thought was unsolvable, and we showed them how they might be able to navigate that. And that has a huge ripple in people's lives.
You know, in retrospect, the way you do business feels pretty courageous. To step out and do things as differently as you did. I mean, most, if not any bank, does business the way you do.
It's not the NBA playbook, is it?
Right, right. And so when you had sort of the vision for your company and the way you wanted to do things, did you ever have a moment of pause and say, you know, I'm going all in on this direction and I hope it works, but it's so different that people may not gravitate to it. Clearly they did, but.
It's interesting. Years ago in the 90s, I literally copied a bank out of Kansas, and they had this little bitty brochure with their values and vision, et cetera. And I literally wrote ours out and just wrote them out. And I thought they were really cool. And there was like no glue inside the company with them. And so back in around 2002 and 2003, when we got really serious about it, we said, hey, we got to go to our employees and let's let them do it. And that's when our culture got really sticky, whenever mm-hmm. I completely let go of it. And what was really interesting when we did that, I'm not even sure how many employees we had at that time, but they were all involved, and we'd go in these rooms with 10 to 20 folks and just say, what are the words that describe our culture? And who do you know? And you think about culture, it's really your behavior. So mm-hmm. how do we want to behave collectively as a company? And so we'd write all these words down on a big chalkboard, and then we narrowed them down. And I'll never forget, I was in my office, and two ladies came in, Carla and Melissa, and said, here's what they came up with. And I'm like, wow. I don't know, I would have had that kind of courage, because the first thing they said was faith. Faith was going to be faith and family and integrity were going to be our core values from a love perspective. Mm-hmm. And we're going to put God first. And I thought, man, that is really courageous for our employees to say, this is really what we're going to stand for. My dad, for years, we'd have an annual meeting. And at the end of the meeting, Dad would get up and say, we're going to put God first, our family second, and work third. And they had heard that for the year, so that's where it resonated. But that really gave us the courage to lean into who we wanted to be as a company in a bigger way. I remember one of my favorite stories ever. We had a lady come into our bank in Paul's Valley, and so faith is one of our values.
Yep.
And so there's a drive-through customer comes in to cash a check, and the lady's crying. Lady that was working with her said, "Are you okay?" And she said, "I'm really not. I just found out I have cancer. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to digest. I just don't know what to do." Mm-hmm. And she said, "Would you mind if I come out and pray for you?"
Wow.
And she walked out. Just think about Paul's Valley, Oklahoma.
Yeah.
Locks up her cash door, walks out into the drive-thru,
yep.
and prays for her for healing. Mm-hmm. And I heard about it. I called her. I said, thank you for being such a leader. And she said, yep. No, you don't understand, Greg. Thank you for creating a work environment to allow me to be who God created me to be. And oh, by the way, I'm a cancer survivor.
Mm, wow.
And I know what it means for someone to pray for you.
When my friend Nancy Eichler started her career at AOL, I'm not sure she expected to fall in love with the customer experience, but that's what happened. She also fell in love with all things digital, social, and the one-to-one impact leaders can have when they engage their customers at every opportunity. We talked with Nancy back in July about her time at Brownie Brittle, and what it was like to take the delicious, chocolatey snack from startup to more than $50 million in sales. Well, breaking into the categories that you guys obviously had to go after, like grocery and retail and snacks, I mean, those are notoriously difficult to get shelf space and to even, find your way in there. How did you guys decide even to where to start?
In order to get it on shelf, we knew we needed some sort of validation or credibility. And the only thing that I could think of at the time was we need to win awards with this product. And if we win awards, then, we can share that. We can do press releases and we can share mm-hmm. that information. We can take it around to trade shows and things and convince retailers that they want to potentially put us on shelf. In addition to that, I actually look at a startup. And I think about the digital space. And of course, that was, my most comfortable zone to be in, having been at AOL for so many years. And what I thought was, digital, a lot of times people will say it levels the playing field for a startup. I actually think it tilts the playing field in favor of the startup. Hmm. And so we went after digital, and I loved social media because this was a place for us to speak directly to the consumer and not only get the consumer to purchase our product either from our website or from a site like Amazon, but also to have the consumers, we actually had a page on our site that the consumer could download and fill out a form and take it to their local retailer and ask them to carry our product.
Nice. Yeah. Smart. Really smart.
Yeah. Yeah. So the whole idea was really engaging mm-hmm. with as many people as we possibly could, as quickly as we possibly could to help us in this process.
You know, and Michael and I talked a little bit about your social strategy and working with some of the early social firms and maybe you've worked with more than one when you were with Brownie Brittle, but the level of engagement that you were looking for and the level of engagement that some of the agencies were willing to provide was different. Can you talk just a little bit about that? Because that, I think, is really, I think it illustrates some of that challenger hustle, which is just so critical to making challenger brands succeed, you know, helping them.
Yeah, well, I felt like if this is, and this is still how I feel today, but I don't work so much on social today. But my feeling is if somebody comes through, if you have a retail storefront and somebody walks through your door and they say, "Hey, I love your stuff." To me, if you don't talk to them, it's disrespectful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you want to thank them, but to me, it wasn't just about liking their posts. It was actually having a dialogue in the same way you would had they come in your retail storefront. Mm-hmm. And that's how I felt that they were gifting us this opportunity to engage with them and possibly make a deeper connection.
Right.
And so I was so committed to that approach on every platform at every level. We even had Sheila had her own Facebook page. So it was both her, you know, everybody who engages with her, I would, you know, kind of insist working with her. And luckily she was a partner in all of this. She was absolutely a believer, you know, in talking to her fans. And so the combination of, you know, her commitment, as well as this idea that, you know, we really wanted to one by one win mm-hmm. over these fans even more, such that they would turn back around and go back out and sort of share the love
for
us.
Yeah. And in the early days, especially on social, that was the big promise, is we can go one-to-one and really do that authentically. And I think maybe in some cases we've lost a thread on that a little bit, you know, with what you see. But certainly there's still great examples. So you know that we're obviously big fans of the challenger mindset. And, you know, Michael was sharing the story about ironing the Brownie Brittle bags. And I'd love you to tell our listeners about that. That's fantastic.
Well, in a startup, you know, you do everything that you can to help it succeed. And, you know, you don't have loads of people around to just, you know, pick up the garbage or, you know, take care of your laptop for you. You know, if you needed any sort of technology, if you needed, you know, Comcast, you were having to call them. If you needed, you know, the floor swept, you were having to do it. And so, you know, I go from a very young age. My father had a commercial air conditioning business where I grew up. And my very first real job was cleaning his office building. So I think that mindset of there's no task too low for you, that we just believed that anything that needed to be done, we were bodies willing to do it.
I love
and
that.
So I have gone down to the bakery several times in the early days where, you know, helping them weigh bags and make sure they were the right, you know, weight. And we had an issue where bags came in and they had pre-applied labels to them and the labels were wrong. And so we had to iron the bags in order to remove those labels. Other companies probably would have just disposed of those bags and bought new bags, but we couldn't afford to.
Wow.
You know, we
love
were
it.
Doing everything we could just to keep the lights on.
Gosh, I love all your examples of the little things that you guys did, you know, to build the relationships with your customers too, which was just a whole nother, you know, group of activities and things that you did really almost one at a time. And it's an awesome reminder that, you know, being a challenger brand is very difficult, you know, and even dealing with things like, you know, the story that you just described. I mean, there's nothing easy about that. It takes a whole lot of work and persistence, but it's also, you know, at the customer level, so important to create, you know, not just customers, but brand evangelists. And I would imagine for a brand like Brownie Brittle, there are just a ton of evangelists. And do you have any sort of favorite brand evangelist stories that you can share with us?
Yeah, we had, you know, again, early on, I think it was maybe 2013 or 14, we found out, and, you know, if you listen to your fan base, they're going to tell you what's happening with your brand. They're going to tell you what's wrong with your product. If you ever have, you know, if there's a bad taste or there's a product texture inconsistency, if their product is lacking somewhere distribution wise, where, you know, maybe a flavor has been out of stock for a while. And if you pay close enough attention, right, they'll mm-hmm. tell you things before you could find them out otherwise.
Right.
And so that was something that we did a lot of, was really listen to our fans, whether through phone calls or emails or postings on social. And there was a gentleman who was an attorney in the Midwest who contacted us and told us that, hey, why is the Midwest Costco discontinuing your product? We didn't know they were discontinuing it. So we immediately got on the phone with the Costco Midwest region to understand what was happening, to find out if in fact this gentleman was right. Turns out he was. And then this gentleman, I started, you know, emailing him, thanking him for the information and telling him what he could do to try to help us get back into Costco. So we also did some postings on social encouraging consumers, hey, go into your Costco Midwest region, tell them if you don't want the product pulled from shelves, go tell them. And suddenly this guy who, you know, I never personally knew him, but he took it upon himself. He took up a letter writing campaign. He even wrote from his own legal office and, you know, on his letterhead telling Costco to please bring this product in or back in.
Wow.
And sure enough, within weeks after we reached out to our fan base and told them that this was happening, we received a call from Costco. They apparently had always intended to bring us back in.
Yeah.
They were going to take us out of rotation and put us back in later, but they brought us in about 6 to 8 weeks earlier than
wow.
was anticipated.
So if you've read The Voice of the Underdog or listened to any of our podcasts, you know Tug and I are big believers that culture flavors everything. That was never more evident than when we sat down and talked with Sarah Zubiate, the founder of Zubi's Salsa and Dips. Sarah talked about how she went from a bond trader to business builder. With little more than an idea and a whole lot of enthusiasm, Sarah started a food business and built her own farm to support it. Sarah's delicious, healthy, plant-based products are selling out everywhere, and in this episode, she shared some of the valuable lessons she's learned as a true challenger brand, her aha moments, and how creating a positive culture made all the difference.
So what are some of those crazy lessons you learned trying to scale from, you know, doing it in your kitchen to mass production?
Well, that's interesting because I, you know, started off just with the salsa. And at that point, I had a fiery one, kind of, you know, habanero base. But then I rotated into HEB, kind of the HEB Central Market realm with those. And in realizing, okay, I have this awesome co-packer in Austin. They've never really worked with something of this particular sort. So in doing the production manufacturing, we certainly ran into issues on the shelf,
mm-hmm.
On the shelf stability front, on lots of things there. So then I went to HEB kind of 7 months into that and said, is there any way that I can focus more Central Market? I kind of moved the operations. I didn't move the operation. I came to a co-packer here in Dallas. And even then, I mean, mass production, they are so concerned with placing things into the product, health,
it's a food
life.
Product.
So it was me kind of wrestling with that a good amount along the way. And then they went out of business, my co-packer.
Oh,
so,
wow.
I mean, in scaling in that capacity, you're trying to find someone to partner with you in the best way. But I learned a lot by working with these folks. And after the second co-packer, they had to file for bankruptcy. It was interesting because at that point I thought, all right, they're making it for a cost that, or we're making it for a cost that I can't continue to sell into retail because I can't get the produce at that price.
Sure.
That was the impetus for me to start my farm, start growing a lot of my own produce and growing. And then I started my own manufacturing facility.
Yeah.
So I got them both certified organic. I'm a zero waste facility powered by solar power energy. And this property has been in my husband's family. And he, you know, his eyes when I said, okay,
here's what I'm doing with the property.
Part of the lot, and this is what I'm going to do.
He's thinking about building a, you know, a cabin on the property. And you got, this little farm you're standing up.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And he was like, you know, have at it. You know, if you can do it. And
How do you feel about 40,000 pepper plants?
Yeah, that's right. But you captured the whole supply chain inside of your...
And especially with my most expensive ingredients.
Yeah.
And, oh my God, even with the organic products I was buying before, to be able to literally go pick them from the earth, bring them over to the facility the day after you chop them, you place them in the product. I mean, you cannot beat that straight out of the ground.
Right.
It's nuts.
Yeah.
It's tough to do organic farming.
But you're able to sustain that and replicate that, and you feel like you're able to scale and grow. That's fantastic.
Yes, absolutely.
It's funny when you were telling us about it, I was fascinated by you that before you were getting the peppers from Mexico.
Yes.
And that
when California. It was both.
Yeah. And that, but then when you moved it to Texas, that the taste was different.
Oh, for sure.
Right.
For sure.
Than it was. Yeah. So it's just another lesson. It's constantly evolving, constantly moving parts. Yes. You know, it's
And our soil there in the Post Oak Savanna Plains, it's very porous. It's complicated to work with, but it makes amazing food.
Yeah.
Well, as a young brand too, I mean, it had to be a Herculean effort to get into the grocery stores to begin with.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, what was that like?
Well, okay, so I've always been a person who kind of keeps friends from like first grade to, you know, college. And a dear girlfriend of mine, she started us kind of doing cashier and bagging when we were in college together. And, you know, we're dear friends. And so she worked, I think, in the HR department for HEB, and she loved it. She was like, you tell me when you're ready to scale, and I'm going to try and get this into the right hands. So thank goodness that ability to foster those relationships. And I didn't even really think, oh my God, this is going to be insane to get into. I just thought, let's do it.
Yeah.
You know, let's do it. Yep. I have to do it. Now's the time. Now's
this
the time.
Is the next logical step. Let's go. Right. Let's get it done.
And I felt like I was ready.
Yeah.
But then there were hurdles.
Right. Always.
Hurdles. Yes. Well, you know, and that leads into culture, you know, because the culture that you build, you know, is it, can you deal with these struggles and hurdles, or is it something that's going to defeat you? So, you know, I know that family obviously has played a huge role in sort of your story. But how does that feed into the culture that you're trying to build at Zubies? You know, is there anything in particular you're doing around that?
Interestingly enough, yes, because I'm a workaholic and self-admitted workaholic, and sometimes it's tough because I can't turn it off.
Mm.
But in all of my prior careers, it really paid off. And where I was. And when I moved over into wanting to start my own company, and I actually did it, I knew that I had to find that balance for my kids.
Yeah.
So I'm not just a woman-owned company. I'm woman-led.
Yeah.
So I have moms working for me.
Oh.
And so my CFO, she's a woman, like publicly traded company CFO type lady. I mean, brilliant lady. And also for my leadership. And so they are, my production manager, she's a woman. And trust me, it was not purposeful because I have guys working for me. But I really wanted that ability to be flexible and to work with the people in a loving, meaningful way. And of course, I can say, all right, we got to plow right now. This is when we grind.
Yeah.
Let me know your schedule. Let me know this. So it's just that culture of really loving the people. If I'm trying to bring people together with all of these differences in the world right now, trying to say it doesn't matter, you know, your religion, your preference, your political affiliation, it doesn't matter. Food, everyone needs food. And so if I have that unity focus, bringing happiness and people together, I got to do that within my company. And
absolutely.
I love it.
Yeah, that's congruence. You know, the, it's inside out, you know, and when we're feeling this internally, that gets expressed externally. We're willing to do things we were talking about in our previous discussion, Southwest Airlines, you know, when people feel like they belong to something special, and you really just beautifully articulated your vision, really your mission, you know, bringing people together over food, you know, connecting.
That's and my name, Subiate, means bridge over a ravine. So kind of the connecting bridge.
It's like it's all meant to be.
Yes, but Subiate is too hard to pronounce. So Zubies it is.
Well, so, you know, so for others who are listening, who are, you know, trying to build their own challenger brands and who, you know, want to build that lasting culture at their own companies, you know, what would you tell them, Sarah? What do you, what sort of advice might you have?
I guess there's so many.
Yeah.
But if I had to pinpoint... get real accustomed and acquainted with failure and rising from it. You know, and if you're not, go do some metaphorical speed dating with it, because I mean, place yourself in really uncomfortable positions where you know you're not really good at something, new skill, new passion, whatever, and fail.
Just
fail and rise again.
At first blush, you wouldn't figure a 100-year-old college directories company would be one of the most engaging, dynamic, best places to work in America. But that it is. Under the leadership of CEO Drew Clancy, Publishing Concepts has revolutionized alumni relations, and they've done it in a way that's made PCI the best company to work for in Arkansas, Virginia, and in Texas, 2 years in a row. How do you do that? It starts by hiring well. In September, we sat down with Drew and Lori Bishop, PCI's Chief People Officer, to hear more about how they've created an extraordinary company culture that serves as a true competitive advantage for PCI. So, Drew, tell us just a little bit about PCI and your sort of journey to back to PCI, if you will.
Well, we are a third-generation family business. Actually, our roots go back to my grandfather, who started our predecessor company in 1921. So I like to think of us as a 100-year-old startup. we work in the college, university, association marketplace. And we talk with over 10,000 alumni or members of various organizations each day. And so that's
10,000 daily
a day.
Wow
incredible.
Yes, incredible.
Well, that clearly takes a lot of people to do that, right?
Yes.
So Lori, I wanted to ask you, earlier in the podcast Mike and I were discussing the importance of hiring people who are complementary to your culture and who help sustain it versus hiring people and then you have to train them up.
Yes, right.
And clearly, I mean, talking with you guys, we know how important the people are to you guys at PCI and how important it is to build a culture, or how it's been to build a culture leading with love and empathy, right? How do you hire the right people for that? I mean, it's an interesting, you know, how do you even start? Where do you even start?
Well, it starts with leadership that's committed to hiring the right people. And Drew is relentless about this and has challenged even my own high expectations for talent acquisition. I like to consider myself pretty good at that. And I would say that our secret sauce has been developing a tool that screens people for our culture. We had the opportunity to build that from scratch, and Drew was really instrumental in making sure that his voice and the voice of the culture showed up in that instrument that we use to screen talent. A couple of other keys has been including our associates in the hiring process. Who better to pick talent than the people who actually do the job? So that's been really key. And Drew reviews each of these selections and makes sure that we are doing what we said we were going to do. He inspects what he expects from us, which is to hold that bar high and never lean towards being fast versus getting the right person. And I think that has helped us to hire well, even in the midst of a pandemic.
Did that just arise out of, hey, this is just the kind of company I want to run? Or did you conceive of it early on as, hey, this could be a real strategic advantage? Was it that intentional?
I wish I was that smart, right? it just seemed like this is the right way. And one of our values is unlock human potential. And I really consider myself a lifelong learner. That's something that, you know, just brings me true joy. Mm-hmm. And so that's really where it started, is let's invest in people. Let's give people opportunity to learn, grow, get better. That's what I was interested in. And as it turns out, it is a great strategy, but it didn't necessarily start that way.
Drew is being modest. This is who he is.
Yeah.
Top down. It's who he is every day. He just doesn't have a different gear or face. This is who he is. From pursuing excellence purposely, he's relentless and challenges us to no end. From really focusing on learning in ways that contribute to our culture, so we find ways to strengthen what we think we know. This is who he is. I can't see him running a company a different way.
Yeah, I have a phrase. It's sort of like, you know, culture is an inside job and it starts at the top.
Right.
And so Drew is exemplifying that just in his remarks.
Absolutely.
Yeah, for sure. Well, and Mike mentioned, you know, in the 90s or back when this all started, you know, nobody was really doing it this way, mm-hmm. or nobody was even thinking about things this way. I mean, early on when you started to, you sort of pictured this different kind of culture that you wanted to build. Was there any concern or trepidation that, you know, people may not buy into this? It's so different from what people are expecting. I mean, you know.
We still have it.
Oh, I mean, absolutely. I mean, it was, it's kind of a grand experiment. And to Lori's point, it still is today. I mean, you know, we've been fortunate to be named a great place to work and lots of places and super exciting. But truthfully, I mean, I think our best days are in front of us. I literally feel like we're just getting started in terms of taking this to the next level.
Right.
Yeah.
So, Lori, from your people, put your people hat on, your HR hat. So for people listening that are trying to build a great culture, they're trying to build that great company, but they have people that just don't fit.
Mm.
What do you tell them?
Get rid of them as quickly as possible. Mm. I consider myself a business person first and an HR person second. And in working for Drew, our first conversation was all about how do we operationalize this culture? And that's what I've spent the last 25 years trying to figure out how to do. I almost left HR because the way that it's done traditionally, it's very obtuse. It gets in the way of good business in a lot of cases. And the focus on compliance and risk mitigation often pushes innovation and creativity and other really important traits in a culture to the side. And really getting an opportunity to work with a leader who gets it at the top is key. You're not going to be successful if you say one thing and do another at the top. It will not work. Yeah. I've tried building cultures like the one we have at PCI with a grassroots approach. And it's, I will tell you, the best word for it is torture, because you'll have these momentous changes happen and they get squashed at the top. So you have to have a passionate leader at the top who gets it, who can be vulnerable, who knows it's a journey, it's a marathon, not a sprint, and who really does get that this is going to be the difference in how we thrive as a business. It's not just the stuff you say. It's not to get buy-in from your people, to get them to do things. It's really, to Drew's point, the right way to run a business, given that a business is made up of people. And people are spending a considerable amount of their time working for you in their business. And that time is spent to support them living the lives that God's given them. That's a lot of responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And far too many leaders of organizations don't take that seriously enough, that numbers of people have decided to spend their life moments with you. And you should make that both value-added, useful in support of their lives, their families. It's just a great responsibility that you should take a lot more stock in making positive for people.
In the midst of the country's largest hiring challenge ever, no one had the pulse of what companies and candidates were looking for better than those in professional staffing. In our October episode, Mike and I sat down with our good friend Elizabeth Bailey, formerly one of our Loomis colleagues and now a branch director at staffing leader Robert Half. Elizabeth brought our listeners up to speed on the new role culture is playing in the hiring process, how companies should handle requests for more benefits, more money, and more flexibility, and how working from home has literally made the job market global.
So tell me, you know, what are some of the cultural things that you think companies need to be doing, you know, right now to attract great talent? You know, Tug and I were talking about this earlier. What is it that you think folks are looking for?
So I think something that's been interesting that I've started noticing is from a benefits perspective that certainly relates itself to culture is that companies are starting to add things like health and wellness, you know, benefits, you know, yeah, gym memberships, you know, mental health resources, right? They have access to, you know, therapists or just places that they can go outside of work to get help or to get some good insight. Those have been new benefits that I've started to see more and more, you know, access to help.
Yeah, help like Better Talk. You know, we did that as an agency. Mm-hmm. You know, we brought in Better Talk or Better Help, I think is what it was called.
Yeah.
And gave it was an extension of their benefits. And this was just sort of during the height of it. It's like, guys, if you need to talk to somebody, here is a virtual option. And we did. We talked a lot about mental health and continue to. And I think from what you're saying, Elizabeth, is that more employers are either doing that or need to start doing that.
Yes.
You know, attend to the whole person and not just, hey, this is what we do at work.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. And things that they can, yeah, opt into or not opt into, right? It's not every, you pick what makes the most sense for you. And I think, you know, just businesses nationwide in general, you know, as that relates to, you know, just diversity and inclusion, mm-hmm, just things that can include more people and make people feel comfortable as them as their true yeah, selves at work is so important.
You know, you bring up diversity and inclusion and equity. Is that coming up among candidates?
It definitely is. And, you know, it's funny, we've seen it. We've all seen it. I was going to say Robert Half has done research, but I know so many have that teams that are more diverse and inclusive are better with problem solving, you know, decision making and innovation. And so I think that has to be at the forefront of leadership. And, you know, candidates are definitely paying attention to that.
Yeah.
Not only in, you know, how companies go about making sure that they're hiring for a more diverse candidate pool, but how that interacts and how that works with the employees that they do have as well. You know, I don't think there's one right solution, mm-hmm, but it's definitely at the top, you know, mind of most leaders that I work with and then candidates as well.
Yeah. Are there some positions that are just particularly hard to recruit for right now? And I, you know, of course we speak in the marketing and advertising, you know, space, and of course, you know, there's implications across all sorts of industries, but you know, what are you finding is like the man, these are the unicorns, are the hard ones to go get and find.
My team specifically is in Dallas-Fort Worth, right? And the marketing and creative side. So I would say anything e-com focused, digital, you know, UI UX designers, people that are focused on making websites work better, those are hard to come by and very in demand. Mm-hmm. But anything that's dealing with digital work, right? Content as well, just the speed at which I was thinking about that on the way here. You know, a newspaper used to get delivered, and that used to be the news for the day. My husband still gets it. And realistically, by the time he opens that newspaper, there's news that's changed and better different. So just the content is something that we are constantly seeing a demand for. And that's across any business, right? Not even in marketing and creative. It's every business is constantly publishing and changing the content and what they're sharing. And it's hard to keep up.
One of the challenges I think for employers is, you know, as you're bringing in new talent, in many cases, you know, the pay grade has been escalating. And so I know some employers are bringing people, because I've talked to other employers, CEOs of companies, where they're bringing in folks that are dramatically outcompensated with respect to their current employees. And so that creates an issue internally. Obviously, there's not a lot of visibility on that in most respects. But, you know, what is your sort of general point of view on that? So if somebody comes to you, and they're asking for a salary that is disproportionate to their skills or background, their experience, all that good stuff, How do you guys counsel them with respect to that sort of thing?
So for us, really, you know, we're talking to clients and companies across the Metroplex and then also the world, right? So we have a lot of information on salary data. And it really, for us, you know, we want candidates to get a fair salary and we want companies to know, hey, this is what candidates are really expecting in this position. So I would say for us, you know, if a company is looking to hire a candidate at a certain salary that maybe feels disproportionately high, we would certainly counsel them on that. You know, it does us no good to give a candidate some outrageous salary because, like you mentioned, it, you know, can mess up the internal salaries. But then also when that candidate goes to look for another job in the future, they've been paid exponentially more than they really should. So, you know, we always are basing our counsel on the market intel and, you know, based on conversations and positions we've placed other candidates in. So I think, you know, companies should be careful with that. If it doesn't make sense, definitely don't do it because this, you know, altering everyone's salary, you know, can really drastically affect how things are internally.
It can, yeah. And some employers, they have different philosophies on it. I've got one friend that I know, it's like, well, we've got to raise everybody up because we brought this person in and we really are, it just, your cost structure completely changes with respect to that. So
I guess the one thing though that I would say to that, that it made me think about is, you know, if the salary that you are planning to offer, it does feel high, it may be a good reason to take a look at what you are paying your internal employees, right? If it's market rate based on, you know, make sure to talk to someone about that or others, you know, if it is market rate and that's what you're, you hear multiple candidates expect that, maybe it is the time to look at your internal employee pay structure and see if that really is market rate because you're putting yourself at risk for those internal employees to take other options or look at other options specifically from a salary standpoint.
Makes perfect sense.
I mean, if you're talking about a raise or you're talking about even a signing bonus, I guess you could treat it that way. I mean, is money still the, or I say still, I'm making an assumption, is money the most important thing people are concerned with still? Or,
you know, I would say no, and only because this one study that I saw the Business Journal published, you know, they, given a choice between an additional $30,000 on your annual salary or the option to permanently work from home, when they sent that survey out, over 64% of respondents chose fully working remotely over the $30,000 pay increase. So, you know, that might not be the same, not everyone, right? It's not 100%, but wow, 64% was a shocking number, especially with, you know, $30,000 isn't chump change. The things that keep people at organizations are the cultural aspects, the things that, you know, the relationships with their managers, managers that are transparent. You know, I think it's great that you share the plan and like, here's what we're wanting to do here with our company, right? You know, employees really value that, feeling like they're included. You know, maybe they're not a manager or a leader, but they want to know what's going on in the organization. I think that's really important to employees these
days.
And
how they contribute to that.
Exactly.
That mission.
Feeling valued.
Yeah, no matter what the position is, you know, where their place is, why it's important, why they're valued. Yeah, that sense of, you know, belonging in that respect.
At work, at home, and in every area of our lives, one thing we all need is more encouragement. But as much as we love getting encouragement, we're not always so great at giving it. Thankfully, entrepreneur James Brown has decided to do something about that. Last month, Mike and I visited with the country's chief encouragement officer about his EncourageX platform and website that are transforming the way we think about and encourage our colleagues, family, and friends.
To get us started, will you tell our listeners a little bit about your background, James?
Oh, for sure. I spent most of my adolescence in the Chicago area before moving to Springfield, Missouri, where I went to Kickapoo High School. Had the opportunity to attend Notre Dame for undergrad. Worked for some large companies like Dow Chemical, General Electric, Kraft. Did my MBA at Kellogg in Chicago. And I've worked in marketing, sales, and strategy for the last 30 years, again, mostly in large corporations, and now working on a personal venture, which is starting to become more corporate in focus, called EncourageX. It's a platform focused on encouraging the people you care about in a very personal, authentic, and consistent way with the primary objective of building happy, healthy, and resilient relationships.
For those who aren't familiar with the platform, can you explain how EncourageX works?
Yeah, it's pretty simple, at least the design of and the intention is if you have someone you care about and you want to encourage them because that relationship is important to you, whether it's personal or professional, the platform allows you to put in a few variables that are critical to that relationship as well as the goals you have for the relationship. So things like, what is your role in the relationship? Is it a manager to employee? Is it father to son? Is it son to mother? Is it coach? Whatever the relationship may be. You then also put in variables related to that person's preferences for all types of things, including music and some demographic information, so that the algorithm that we've custom designed allows you to get recommendations on how you can encourage that person, not just once, but several times over the course of weeks, months, even years, depending upon what the life event topics and situations may be. And then you select from one of four categories: words and phrases you can use to encourage them, audio, video content, gifts and goodwill. And my favorite personally is the fourth category, which is called events and experiences. Everything from acts of service, some of the love language philosophy is imbued within that idea. Even questions you can ask during conversations to really help that person be seen, heard, validated, and reinforced and supported in ways that, again, make them feel like they have a Tracy that's there to support them. Even if the world seems upside down and totally against them, you can be that one person that's always there to be supportive. Even as we look at the divorce rates in this country, usually when people start out, there's lots of hope, lots of excitement, but what a lot of the data will tell you is that there's usually one person's trying harder than the other person. Or both people are trying less hard before they got married. It's very rare that both are trying harder after their nuptials.
There's some brutal honesty for you.
The interesting part of what we're starting to get feedback on from folks that are using it to encourage their significant other, whether it be husband, wife, spouse, whatever gender, how people associate, even, people that they're dating, a lot of folks are saying, I'm rediscovering my partner in ways that some of those microaggressions that we find ourselves slipping into, we're starting to replace those with micro encouragements.
That's fantastic.
You have to understand, for me, it's truly online with the vision and the mission.
Yep.
Is that if you have good intentions, we help you to translate those into meaningful and appropriate encouragement experiences. A lot of us find ourselves slipping into the habit of saying and doing things we saw on TV the night before. Like, it may have been hilarious on Friends or Seinfeld, but when it comes to trying to build a happy, healthy, and resilient relationship, sometimes we need to actually get better content, right? In ways of finding the way to be and do things that are truly encouraging. And that's what we're all about.
Are there any success stories that stick out on more of the corporate side for you about how companies have helped transform themselves and done a better job with their employees?
Or how individuals have used it? Exactly.
Yeah, there's a couple stories. Some of my favorites are actually at Comcast. I won't share the names just for a privacy perspective, but some of the deployments have helped managers, leaders of leaders actually address some issues with supervisors that are great technically competent leaders, but when it comes to dealing with their employees, either they grew up in an environment culturally but didn't really spend a lot of time encouraging on the personal or professional side, or they just don't see it as part of their core job. Mm-hmm. One in particular that always resonates with me is we're working with a team of managers, and we noticed that of the 10 pilot team members, one of them had just not scheduled any encouragements, you know, during the first 6 weeks of deployment. And it's a conversation about, you know, is there something wrong with the technology? It's like, no, it's just haven't had time. And before I knew it, this had turned into a very internal meeting where he was being challenged with great energy from his peers about he just hadn't done his job. And I started feeling kind of uncomfortable because we're supposed to be the encouragement company, right?
Right. Right. Hey, why haven't you been encouraging? Yeah.
So I kind of got the look from the director to kind of step back and let him take over the meeting, which he did with great brilliance. Started to ask a series of questions about, you know, what was the holdup? And, you know, in the middle of this, I'll call it an intervention, you start to see this employee start to get, you know, a little uncomfortable. And his face started turning red, and he actually started getting the shaky lip as he was trying to express himself. And
it's very uncomfortable.
I remember the manager saying, "Hey, just talk to us for a second. Like, what's going on?" And he said, "Look, I apologize. I haven't done my job here because it's something I don't feel that comfortable doing. So in my culture," and I would just say it was a culture outside of United States per se. He said, "We just don't do a lot of this because I'm really struggling at home and at work with trying to get to know people." He said, my wife, who is not from my culture, said that, you know, the kids are asking, does daddy really love us? Because he never says it. And he started to cry a little bit. And I'm thinking, oh my God, this is just, it's crazy how this is a whole person experience. This is not a work thing. Long story short, the director said, "Hey, we're going to get you some help. We got you. We're going to support you." And assigned one of the more senior leaders to work with him. And what was amazing is the next 10 weeks, you started seeing this manager encouraging employees. And there were two metrics that really shined really bright for this young manager. That his employee net promoter score, or ENPS, went up about 9 points. It was the highest increase in the region that quarter. And then also qualitatively or anecdotally, when the director met with his people, he asked, you know, how things were going. He said, "You know, this guy started sending us these encouragement notes, and we had no idea this guy even had a heart, you know, to speak of. It's like all of a sudden, you know, he's starting to do things. Like it's, I don't know where he got this idea, but it's really breaking down walls to help us." I think challenging folks is really important, but you want to challenge based upon all the learning we've done with our psychologist, Dr. Joel Wong, is you want to challenge people in a way that leaves them whole, that leaves them empowered and feeling like they can do it. And if they need help, that you're there to help coach them. So there's lots of ways to do it. I just don't think belittling people is a way, which I see a lot of managers doing. Even when you watch, you know, Monday Night Football, you see a coach is yelling at a player. So now you're thinking, got to be a better way to lead people.
Yeah, no doubt. I love what you said. So your chief psychologist said you want to challenge them in a way that I think you said leaves them whole, hopeful, and feeling like they can do it. Run that through again, James. That's very interesting, because I do think, you know, when we have to offer critical feedback, boy, I see it just done so terribly. But that sounds like a really wise nugget. I'd love you to just dive into that just a little more.
Yeah, for sure. So the idea is to leave the human being whole, meaning you don't want that interaction to remove some of the possibility in the relationship. So you always want to get back to 100.
Yeah.
And when people say and do things that are either unforgivable in the minds of the recipient,
mm-hmm.
or are personal attacks that are more focused on the other person's insecurity, it removes some of the possibility.
Yeah, it does. And, I love that.
And when you are challenging people, it is important to, one of my sayings is, be hard on the problem, but soft on the people. Hard on the problem, soft on the people. So you get really focused on the goal, give people everything that they possibly need. And if they're not able to achieve it, then it's actually an easier conversation to counsel through. And if it gets to the point where it's just a bad fit, it's a much easier conversation on counseling out. And I do have a couple clients that have used EncourageX to basically try to encourage someone who they think is not going to make it. It's made the exit on a few of those cases to be much more graceful, leaves the brand more intact, and the ones are able to actually save in a way that they're able to respond to the challenge. It's a great story for everyone.
Well, that's it for this episode, and that's it for our first season of the Voice of the Underdog podcast. We hope you've enjoyed our discussions this year, and certainly hope you'll join us again next year for season 2, starting in January. If you'd like to know more about challenger branding and how you can build the kind of company culture that changed the game for the leaders you've heard today, order a copy of The Voice of the Underdog, How Challenger Brands Create Distinction by Thinking Culture First at Amazon or Barnes & Noble. Big thanks to all our guests this year and for their time and insights. Thanks to everyone at Lumina Sound Studios for hosting us. And most of all, thanks to all of you for listening and sharing our podcast with your colleagues and friends. For my co-author, Michael Tuggle, I'm Mike Sullivan. Thanks for joining us. Have a happy holiday season and a wonderful new year. This is the Voice of the Underdog.